Welcome back to Catching Up on Capitol Hill, a series in which we discuss the latest in tax legislation and in tax policy. I'm your host, John Gimigliano. Well, it happened. The tax cliff is no more, and Congress has enacted the One Big Beautiful Bill legislation. We've been talking about this for so long, well, almost as long as I can remember. And in one sense, I think we've been talking about it all the way back to 2017 when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was first enacted, setting up the tax cliff. But certainly on this podcast, we've been talking about it all year. And now it's over. And yeah, there's so much more to say about what happened and what does it mean for the future of tax policy. And I promise you, we're going to get to that. But I think the thing I'm struck by, and I imagine many of you are as well, is how quickly the pace with which this legislation developed and it was enacted. In fact, I want to come back to that very topic at the end of today's episode. But first, let's have our first take about what this legislation means to taxpayers and to tax policy specifically. So today, let's talk about who are the winners and who are the losers in this bill. To help me do that, we are joined by our old friends, Jen Acuna and Dan Winnick. All right, so let's just start with a couple winners. Jen, can you name for us who is at least one winner in the new legislation?
Obviously, this was a very big package, and the extensions were on the individual side. I would definitely have to say that kind of a winner is certainly, you know, the individual taxpayer that was spared, you know, the increases in the rates. That also, I kind of bundle that in with the high SALT state taxpayer, where they got some relief on the individual SALT limitation. It's kind of winning, but not winning as much as they could have won, but certainly solidly in the win category.
Yep, we did not go over the tax cliff. That's a win right there for individuals. Exactly. Okay, that's an obvious one, but an important one. It was kind of the whole point of the bill. Good one, Jen. What about you, Dan? Give us another winner.
So I've been really focused on the winners on the international side. I think the most significant thing on international that we were thinking about was potential Section 899 retaliatory measures, those disappearing from the bill. In light of the G7 agreement, was a huge win for inbound taxpayers. And then on the outbound side, in the Senate bill, we saw pretty dramatic changes to the U.S. international tax system that are going to really change how a lot of companies think about where they locate functions, assets, and risks, and especially the expansion of the deduction for foreign derived deduction eligible income and the removal of the deemed return for QBI. Those are all going to be big wins for companies with a lot of R&E and a lot of property in the United States.
So let's just dig into that a little bit more. It's interesting, Dan. So first of all, the inbounds, I think we all get that, right? They win by not losing because they were in grave jeopardy of losing for a long time. Certainly in the House bill, that was a possibility and could have been in the Senate bill as well. But let's talk about for the U.S. multinationals or the outbounds a little bit more. So specifically, what fact pattern is that we're looking at where you wake up after this bill's enacted and say, oh, there's an opportunity for us to potentially be in a better position?
One big fact pattern is if you have a lot of property in the U.S. that might have reduced your FDII deduction because it's reduced by the deemed return on that tangible property. Before, FDII was about intangible income. Now, because it's really looking at export sales without regard to that tangible property that's contributing to it, I think it expands potentially the universe of investors who might benefit from it. The other big change was the change to how expenses are treated for GILTI and FDII by eliminating allocation of expenses for interest and for R&E. That also is to FDII and to GILTI. That's also going to expand the availability of those deductions and, again, encourage more functions in the United States.
Interesting. Okay. All right. So those are two winners, but maybe it wasn't all unicorns and rainbows. Jen, let me come back to you. Anybody jump out as a potential loser in the bill?
Certainly. I just kind of continuing this international theme. And it's not because, you know, international was the biggest part, but it's the most reformy piece of the tax title of the Big Beautiful Bill. That's where they made the most architectural changes. I would say that one of the, I wouldn't say solidly losing, but certainly not all unicorns and rainbows were U.S. multinationals that were guilty taxpayers that had significant amounts of QBI that allowed them to reduce the amount of guilty that they were subject to. Because remember, those taxpayers, now there's no QBI, so they don't have that cushion, and they're all in on guilty and at a higher rate. So I would put them squarely in the losing category.
And that's basically the flip side of what Dan just described, yep. Right? Yeah, exactly. All right, that's an interesting one. Okay, that's one. Dan, who else is a potential loser here?
So moving on from the international section, one of the top line items in the whole bill was the changes to the energy and IRA credits. In the end, those transition rules probably ended up surprising a lot of taxpayers, and especially the introduction of the foreign entity of concern rules, even for tax credits that appear to be protected in the first instance. So figuring out how those are all going to be implemented, especially with the executive order dealing with those credits, I think that's going to be a big challenge.
Yeah, that one, I think we all saw coming, but it's painful. There's no doubt about it. Now, look, it wasn't the worst of all case scenarios. I think the House bill would have been worse, but it certainly isn't good. And the FEOC stuff, as you mentioned, is really interesting, right? It really hits heavily upon the ability for energy producers of all sorts to acquire equipment from certain countries, you know, China being an obvious one. But it's not only that, it's also those entities of concern themselves, right? So if you're a large seller of products into the U.S., you know, you're a Chinese solar panel manufacturer, like, that hurts too. So it hits on both sides on FEOC. And yeah, that's a very real one. All right, let's go back to winners again for a second. All right, Jen, who else is a winner in this?
I would say certainly the private foundations, moving away from international again, the private foundations, if you all recall, the original House bill had an increase and the tiered structure for foundations and university endowments. Foundations were stripped out, so they clearly winners in this bill.
Right, sort of like 899. They win by not losing, and that's good
exactly.
enough.
Exactly.
Right, that's a good one. Who else, Dan? Who else wins?
Going along with Jen's point about private foundations, the evolution of the university endowment tax, overall, I think they'd be a bit of a loser in the bill, but it wasn't as bad as what was in the House bill with the lower rate. At the same time, the charitable sector now is faced with greater limitations on charitable deductions, both for corporations, and the new limitation on itemized deductions for individuals also will impact charities. But then on the flip side, we have the reintroduction of the above-the-line charitable deduction. So a lot moving there in both directions on the charitable side.
All right, that's a fair one. Now, I feel like I should go back to losers, but I'm not sure there are that many losers in this bill. I mean, it feels like there were far more winners than losers. But let me just ask you again. First of all, do you agree with that, Jen? And then can you think of another winner here we'd want to highlight?
I agree. There are definitely more winners than losers in this bill, because there's also the broad category of winner, permanence, right? The stability in the system. There was a lot of permanent tax policy that made it through the bill. So that's a win for everyone. Another more specific win, again, going back to international, were companies that kind of won by not losing, were companies that were concerned about a potential round-tripping provision, solidly in the win category that did not come to fruition. And I count that as a significant win.
Yeah, that's one that we know that Republicans have been talking about at the staff level anyway throughout the course of the year, but never surfaced in either House or Senate. So again, a win by not losing. Okay, Dan, how about another winner? Maybe small business world? What do you got over there?
Well, the extension, Jen already mentioned the extension of individual provisions, but the extension of Section 199A was very big in the individual world. And then the continued deductibility of entity level taxes for pass-through businesses. So maintaining broadly the principle that items calculated at the business level for pass-throughs are kind of treated the same as corporations, kind of leaning into parity there, I think was another win for pass-through businesses. To the point that Jen made about there not being so many losers here, a lot of the negative provisions in the bill on the tax side ended up coming out in the negotiations as the bill evolved in the House and the Senate. And since they were able to maintain compliance with the revenue requirements that they needed to stay within without having those pain points, that's how the bill moved forward. To the extent there's any risk there, it's really about what does the interest rate environment look like going forward? Do borrowing costs increase if they're increased debt costs for U.S. Treasuries? So maybe no immediate losers on that front.
Yeah, and this is something we did an episode on and we talked about intermittently during the course of the year is the Senate's accounting here took so much pressure off revenue raisers, either through spending cuts or tax increases, the current policy baseline. It was kind of the magic of the current policy baseline is why I think, you know, whether you like it or not, put that aside. But the fact that we didn't have as many tax increases as you might have otherwise. So, Jen, let me come back to you now. Let's talk about people for a second. The Senate winning on current policy baseline, can you think of any individuals who won by getting that through?
Well, certainly, when you're talking about the current policy baseline, Senator Crapo, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, made a pitch for current policy to be used as the baseline. And there was some pushback, and eventually, and it had never been done before in tax, solid win, made it all the way through, carried it through, and provided, like you said, it took a lot of pressure off of the tax title, a lot of pressure off of potential offsets, and really turned this into, you know, I used to joke that the current policy baseline was like a unicorn baseline. Turned the unicorn into a reality.
Yeah. And to Crapo's credit, I guess you would say that this isn't just something he came up with today. If you remember in the previous extenders bill, right, that was part of the Wyden-Smith deal, right? Crapo was opposed to that. And part of the reason, I don't know how publicly he was speaking about it, but this very notion that, well, are we going to pay for extenders? Right, setting he didn't want, I think, at least set himself up with the precedent of we have to pay for extenders, because I'm sure at that time he was already thinking about the possibility of current policy baseline. And I guess you have to give Budget Chair Lindsey Graham his fair share of credit here as well, right, Jen?
Absolutely. And remember, the Budget Chair, per the Budget Act, is the lead on the baseline. So moved the bill through quite efficiently using the current policy baseline and really was able to unlock and limit the amount of tax pain that had to be doled out in the bill.
All right, Dan, how about another individual that you would look at and say they won in some fashion in this bill?
So when I look at what happened in this bill, I again look at the Senate Republicans as having, in the end, really dominated the process. Going into this bill, I looked at the narrow majority in the House of Representatives, coupled with the recent history of the House being more fractured, and thought that this was the moment when the House was finally going to get its way. In the end, it seemed like the Senate was where the details got worked out. And of course, House Republicans were more skeptical of current policy baseline than Senate Republicans, and the Senate approach ended up winning out. The scoring is always more important in the Senate than in the House, because the Senate is more tied to strict compliance with the budget reconciliation rules. It'll be interesting to see whether the precedent of the Budget Committee chairman getting to determine whether the instructions are complied with, how that impacts future budget reconciliation bills. I think that's a big open question. Another possible winner were actually House Democrats, including Leader Jeffries. Compared to past budget reconciliation bills, there was no hint of defections on the Democratic side leading up to the vote. So during the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there were at least discussions about whether some Democrats would vote for the bill, even though none did. Here, it didn't even get that far. And of course, Leader Jeffries, his magic minute speech that can go on as long as he wants, broke a new record. So that helped firm up his leadership going into the midterms.
Yeah, I think that the Jeffries floor speech that I think, what was it, 8 hours or something like that, we were a little annoyed, not because we were bothered by him taking his privilege of his magic minute, but more by like, Okay, we've got work to do. Let's just get this bill passed. But I have to say that I think he did it for a couple of reasons, one of which is to show that he was not just going to roll over and let Republicans do this. It wasn't much he could do to stop it, but at least give the appearance of doing everything he could to fight against it. Also, making progressives happy. And let's not forget, he's a New Yorker, and if you've been following the local news in New York, right, a very progressive candidate for mayor who appears like he's likely to win. Being able to, I think, prove his progressive bona fides was an important move for him as well, just to shore up his own position. So I think for a lot of reasons, that speech and the way he handled this, I'm with you, Dan. I think that that was the best he could accomplish with the hand that he was dealt on this. Let me ask you both another question. Maybe we'll wrap on this. We said, I think a lot of people said it was conventional wisdom, and I sort of agreed to it. If the House was ever going to have leverage over the Senate, ever, right? Because that we know the rule that the Senate always rolls the House, especially in reconciliation. But the House looked like the Senate with that narrow margin. You sort of hit on this, Dan. But they didn't. In the end, the Senate bill got enacted lock, stock, and barrel. Was the House a loser in this, and was the Senate the winner?
Absolutely. The House lost the battle. Although, I mean, that's kind of a winner and a loser. They got to pass a bill. So overall, that's a win.
Right.
But the House got rolled. Once again, it's a tale as old as time. And like you said, if there was ever a moment when that was possible for the House, as former House staffers, you always dream of like one day the House is not going to get rolled. Didn't come to pass. Did not come to pass. Not this time.
Did not come to pass. Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
So as a former House staffer, I do always dream of the moment when the House wins in a reconciliation bill, and I haven't seen it happen yet. One thing I'll say is that even if institutionally you can say, well, the Senate won and the House lost, I think for individual members, it's more complicated. The Senate, by going second, understands a little bit better where the political pain points are and the policy pain points because the House's proposal has been public and might put the Senate in a better position to respond to concerns. And so I think sometimes even individual House members might prefer the Senate product, though it is a member by member question. The Senate process can be so arduous that once you get the chance just to take it back to the House and take a quick day and a half series of votes to pass it into law, the temptation to do that is very strong, rather than, say, going to conference to get a few relatively small changes. And so in the last couple reconciliation bills, we just haven't seen enough incentive for House members to use that prerogative. It's still a power they have and might influence what the Senate does, but this pattern that we've now seen in the last four reconciliation bills, where the Senate mostly gets to make the final decisions, I think we can learn something from that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one last feeble attempt to as another former House staffer to say that the House didn't get completely rolled here is that the Senate did, as they were developing their bill, repeatedly say, whether it was true or not, that they were trying to draft it in a way that they knew could pass the House, right? They did not want to go ping pong back and forth. And so that they made accommodations to the House as they went. Now, is it actually true? I don't know. But it is possible that had the margin been different in the House, that the Senate bill might not have looked like the one that we saw, that it was at least an effort to get part of the way towards the House. Whether or not that's true or not, well, I don't know. Jen, Dan, that was awesome. Thank you very much. There's going to be a lot more to say about this new legislation. First, we had to figure out what to call it, but that's for another episode. So thank you for that discussion today. In closing, I want to come back to the pace with this legislation and how quickly it happened. If you heard me speak in person or on a webcast or even on this podcast, I think you know I was a little skeptical that this could get done by the 4th of July. And in fact, I felt like really the earliest this could realistically happen was by the end of the summer when Congress went on its August recess, and it realistically could have gone beyond that. Well, let me say, obviously, I was wrong. And that's why being in this business of trying to understand what Congress may or may not do, it's a humbling one. It's hard enough to predict a negotiation between two people, but predicting a negotiation between 535 lawmakers, well, that's all art, no science. But if you had asked virtually anybody in Washington in the spring, would this thing have happened by 4th of July? I think only the most fervent believers in the capabilities of Congress to pass tax legislation would have said yes. So I guess the question is this: what does it tell us about how legislation is done today? And do we need to unlearn how it used to be done? Because the old way, including during my time working on Capitol Hill, well, it was a deliberate, transparent process, you know, that took weeks, months, sometimes years to do. And the big complaint then was it took too long. Well, I think one lesson we can take from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was that speed was perhaps an essential ingredient to passing big, complex pieces of legislation. And even consider this, you know, the Build Back Better legislation, we saw that that was more old school, how slowly and methodically it moved. But of course, it didn't pass. And I think the lesson to take away even from Build Back Better was that what did become law was not Build Back Better, but it was the Inflation Reduction Act, which followed it. And that was done more or less behind closed doors with a very small group of senators negotiating it. And it was kind of sprung upon us at the very last second. And now we have this bill, which zoomed through Congress once it really finally got started. Now, look, you can like this approach or you can not like it. I get it. And I imagine there are things for you not to like. For example, the ability for taxpayers to weigh in on the proposals as Congress is considering them to make sure they work as they're actually intended. Well, that's one thing that jumps to mind. But complaining about this, well, it's mostly howling at the moon at this point, because this is simply how things are done in Washington now. And changing that, it's just not going to happen overnight. So if there's a takeaway for today, I suppose it's this. There's another tax bill coming. I know that because, well, there's always another tax bill coming. Waiting for that bill to materialize, to interface with policymakers on what they should or shouldn't do or how they should or should not do it, well, that's just simply too late. This isn't exactly a novel idea, but it's the one thing I wanted to leave you with. We should all take a minute, figure out what just happened, pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and, well, start the discussions with Capitol Hill anew, and do that soon. With that, thanks for tuning in to Catching Up on Capitol Hill. We'll be back with more on the new law soon. Until then, take care, and I hope to see you soon.